Good day, Thomas Jefferson Hour podcast listeners. We're so glad you're here. Thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting the show.
This is our retrospective program on the year 2017, the 52 original programs we did on the Thomas Jefferson Hour. My daughter, Catherine, is in studio with us here in the new Enlightenment Radio Network barn. Catherine, I'm hoping that all of Scotland listens to this show.
Oh, no doubt. I'm sure.
Let me set you up, Mr. Jenkinson, if I might.
Please.
There were a couple of shows that didn't get mentioned, and one was titled The Magic of the Word.
About my new Shakespeare series. I do a one-man show. I'd love to do it all over. Where I come out, I'm not portraying Shakespeare, but I talk about the plays. I recite sonnets and great soliloquies. That was a program that we did. We did a number of out-of-character programs this year, and I was so glad that we finally wrapped up our 101 series. Not that I was ready to quit, but at some point you have to release it and get on with it.
I don't know. I could have gone on and on, but we're not done with the pitch yet. You, as long as we're talking about your one-man shows, let's talk about the cultural tours too. You've got something coming up at Loxa Lodge.
Ooh, two of them. One is
really quick too.
January 10th.
So it might be too late for listeners to get in
on
that.
No, it's never too late.
Never too late. We have a few places left. One is on Walden. Thoreau's Walden, my favorite American book, and there's a new biography of Thoreau, which is outstanding, by the way. And then also that week, Desert Solitaire, which is a sort of 20th century Walden written by Edward Abbey. So those two, and King Lear. And then there's a day off, and then on the 15th of January, also at this lodge just west of Missoula, easy to get to, one of the loveliest places I've ever visited, we're doing 5 days on Shakespeare. And that comes out of the Shakespeare program I'm doing. In fact, just this morning, before we drove out to the barn, David, I was reading Measure for Measure. But this seminar will include Hamlet, As You Like It, Twelfth Night, Macbeth, King Lear, Othello,
Henry the Fourth, Part One.
We only have a limited time for these introductions.
Right. I'm just saying that this is like these two seminars are in a beautiful place with great food, good wine, magnificent winter river, kind of the...
See, that's all you needed to say.
And just to correct you, Dad, the first retreat, the To Live Deliberately, Walden and Edward Abbey's Desert Solitaire, is the 10th through 15th,
right.
And the Shakespeare retreat is the 17th through 22nd. You can go to the Jefferson Hour website, or you can go to audytours.net. That's O-D-Y tours.net.
My daughter's web savvy, and I am not, but it's 10 through 15 on Walden and Desert Solitaire, and then 17 through 22...
That's correct.
Of January in this incredible lodge. It's the book club you always wanted to be in, and that is on Shakespeare.
I also wanted to talk about something we have done for our loyal listeners,
oh, yes.
Our 1776 Club listeners. On December 22nd, we posted every one of Clay's essays from 2017.
The so-called Jefferson Watch.
Right, and it leads me into the pitch. I'll make it, I'm sure you've heard it before, I'll make it quick, but we so appreciate those of you who have decided to support the Thomas Jefferson Hour. The Thomas Jefferson Hour is completely listener-supported. We have no corporate sponsors and have no intentions of going down that path. So we are dependent upon you as listeners to help support the show. Now, many of you, towards the end of the year, went and did a donation at the website, which is tax-deductible. Many others of you have chosen to support the show by joining the 1776 Club. And for a very small monthly fee, you get access to all sorts of stuff, almost every episode that ever has been published for the Thomas Jefferson Hour. But just now, on December 22nd, we put up this year's collection of all of the essays from 2017. It's our way of saying thanks to you guys, and we hope you enjoy it. You can listen to it as an entire album or episode to episode. It's all been remastered. And
so what, is it 4 hours worth of me?
About 4 hours,
wow,
of your essays, yeah.
Yeah, I actually love doing the essays. It's something new that we inaugurated in the year 2017. I love to write occasional pieces, essays. It's my favorite literary form.
And I must say.
Yes, sir.
This week's essay, I was a little disappointed in you.
Why?
Because you were so pessimistic.
I looked forward to a better 2018.
Yeah, but that's not where you started.
Aren't you worn down?
Me?
By this year?
No.
No?
No.
No.
As I said in the show, I mean, I think the pendulum swings up and down, and it needs to be down before people can see up. And if you look at what's happened in the last month, you see signs of that.
Well, let me ask this question to our listeners. They have a chance now to hear the Jefferson Watch for the last show of the year, which you thought was too pessimistic, and therefore you were somewhat disappointed. Let's let them decide, not whether I'm right or not, but whether they thought that that was too pessimistic a take, or that they want more optimism, even if it wasn't.
Well, you ended with this wonderful list of
things we can do.
Yeah, and that I really liked very much.
I have to say, this year has been really hard on my spirit, and I think I don't have to explain that. This is the president and his detractors and his advocates and supporters and the Roy Moore story and Korea, et cetera. This has made this a really alarming year.
But Jefferson built his life on, whether it was lip service or not, on his optimism about people.
I'm with you, so I'm going to give an alternative essay at this moment.
Okay.
Thomas Jefferson believed that in the long run, things were going to get better, more scientific, more rational, more hopeful, and that people would be happier and freer, and that the march of freedom could not be stopped. It would have occasional setbacks, but that in the long run, the people of the world were going to live in republics, and they were going to have due process and bills of rights, and they were going to be jealous of their freedoms, and that those freedoms would continue to expand until the world came to something like a pragmatic utopia. And I think you can't know Thomas Jefferson or be his mouthpiece unless you share that view. Sometimes you have to take the long view to feel that optimistic, but if you can't feel it, you should get out of this business.
I'm working hard, and I've learned it from you and Jefferson. Thanks for that, and I think it's time we go to the show.
Hey, everyone. We so appreciate you. 2018 is going to be a great year. Catherine, Missouri, Walker Jenkins, and my beloved child, now on interim between degrees or lives. We so appreciate your coming to the barn. You can see, I think, there are many barn detractors. I don't think you're one of them.
No, I'm not a barn detractor.
Oh, and thanks for the pie last week. It was great.
The mince pie.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yeah, it was terrific.
Yeah, she didn't mince words.
Wow.
Oh, you're the punter.
And now to the show. Thank
you. Here we
go. Good day, citizens, and welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with or about President Thomas Jefferson. I'm this week's host, David Swenson, and seated across from me, I am pleased to say, is the creator of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, Mr. Clay Jenkinson, and also his daughter, Catherine Jenkinson, and I welcome both of you.
Catherine, back by popular demand. Catherine has been a graduate student at the University of St. Andrews. Before that, she was a classicist at Columbia. Now she's just between choices, determining whether to go into the workplace or get a law degree or to do a PhD. Catherine, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And she has such great stamina, too. I mean, you're so mean to her, and she keeps coming back.
It's true.
Yeah, I'm on your side.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Anyway,
great.
I'm really excited about this week's show. We take the last week of a year to do a retrospective, look back at the year we've just completed and talk about some of the shows that we've done and the subjects that have come up. And I'd like to start first by saying thank you to all of our listeners and our supporters of the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Without you, we are nothing.
So, David, I want to thank our listeners, too. This is one of my favorite shows of the year. You know, we do 52 original Jefferson Hours per annum. We make it a habit to do a full 52. And so that's a lot of Jefferson discourse that we like to look back on at this time of the year.
I do too. Retrospective at the end of the year is great. And I really do look forward to each week having a chance to either talk with you or to Mr. Jefferson. It's therapy for me.
It's one of the great continuities of my life. You know, when I think about my life, I travel a lot. I'm involved in a wide range of projects. I'm spinning many plates. One of the things that has been most remarkable for me in the last 10 years is coming here to the barn every other week, usually. We do two programs at a time, typically. And the friendship that has developed between us, it always existed, but it has grown until it's one of the most important things in my life. And I'll tell you, one of the things that people say to me when I travel is they say, please say hello to David. He should travel with you sometimes. But they all say, we can hear the friendship. we can hear the friendship on the air. And you told me once when we were first starting, you're a radio professional and I'm not, you said they can hear you smile. Mm-hmm. And I was so surprised by that because I thought, what? But they said they can hear your moods through the microphone and through the miracle of radio.
Oh, I think that's really true. I mean, it's a level of enjoyment. It's like a bad weatherman, somebody who's not talking to you. You just don't hear what he's saying. And you are such a wonderful communicator, and you know so much about Jefferson, which is one of the great pleasures that I have in the show. But let's do what we were going to do and look back at the episodes from 2017. Now, we ended 2016. It was sort of a turbulent time. The elections had just happened, and at least half of the country was unhappy and pretty unhappy. And we talked about that a bit.
Yes, and you know, this, I have to say, 2017 has been a volatile, chaotic, confusing, dispiriting time. And I think that we're still living with this momentous movement, the Brexit movement in Britain, the Trump movement in the United States, the xenophobia, the America Firstism, American nationalism, a concern about our borders, a concern about Islamic terrorism, a concern about health care. You'll hear it today in the Jefferson Watch. But, you know, I think we're living through, in my lifetime, the most uncertain period. And I think that the shows that we've done this year in some ways reflect that, David.
And for me, through the eyes of Thomas Jefferson, I found a lot of comfort in the disturbances of government because of his long view. I'm going to skip ahead to March, and we did a show where we talked to an author, Charlie Slack, about his book, Liberty's First Crisis. Do you remember that show?
Yes, I do.
And that really helped me a lot because it was like, we think it's crazy now. Well, look what those guys went through.
Now, we will get through this, and that's what you're calling the long view. Jefferson's optimism, his belief that the system will work, it's an engine that will self-correct, and that the people are the only safe repository, and the people may go wrong for a short period of time, but it self-corrects, and they return to the center. I take that optimism, too. In fact, this year I have leaned on Mr. Jefferson, I think, more than ever before. And here's the tragedy of it for me, David, is that because of other dynamics in the culture, Jefferson's reputation is in such disarray over slavery, American Indians, Sally Hemings, etc. And I think the fact is we need him now more than ever. And I wish that we somehow could bifurcate the 87 or 90% of Jefferson that we absolutely need as a culture and can't live without. And because we don't have it percolating in the way that it should, the culture is in trouble, from the other 10 or 13% of things that we all freely want to jettison about Jefferson. I mean, I don't think there's anybody left who wants to defend him on some of these, on the darker sides of his life and character. But to get stuck there and to miss the optimism, the articulation of the American dream, the belief that the people are sovereign, that the people have the good sense and integrity to direct their lives in a meaningful way, the need to be well-educated and well-informed, the need to be civil, all those things, I really hate to see us jettison that.
It gave me a lot of solace to talk with Charlie Slack and to read his book because it made me realize, you know, we think we're in trouble now. We look at the partisanship that's going on now. And my goodness, during Jefferson's time, the level of partisan politics was almost indescribable. And, you know, the right of free speech was being taken away. So we survived. So it gave me a lot of hope. Catherine, you've got the list of shows in front of you. Is there anyone that you would like to talk about?
Well, I think to the point you just made, David, we should talk about the Logan Act episode, which you did the end of February this year. Any new responses to thoughts about that as the year has kind of evolved forward?
Well, let me just quickly say what the Logan Act is. It was passed because a man named Logan, a Quaker, took it upon himself to go to France and to try to negotiate an end to the crisis, the international tension between the United States and Napoleonic France, the France of the French Revolution. And This was meddling by a citizen in the official foreign policy of the United States. It wasn't illegal, but then Congress passed the Logan Act saying citizens do not have the right to go over the top of their State Department, to go over the top of their government, and to negotiate with foreign powers. And this, of course, came up because of the Russia problem that some members of the Trump campaign and the transition team and possibly members of the Trump administration are alleged to have had connections and communications with foreign powers, Turkey, Ukraine, the former Soviet Union, Russia, that at least technically appear to violate the Logan Act. That was the sense of it, wasn't it, David?
I believe so. I also think it's interesting to note that nobody has ever been successfully prosecuted with the Logan Act.
And I don't think that will be the case here either. I think that if this crisis, which has been kind of under the radar for a while because there have been so many more immediate things going on, the emergency election in Alabama and so forth, and the crisis with North Korea. But I think that this issue, this collusion issue, is going to lead to a constitutional crisis in the year 2018. And it won't be the Logan Act. I think that what we'll see probably are a series of indictments for obstruction of justice.
Really?
And also perjury. I think that what happens is that whatever happened in the campaign and in the first months of the Trump administration, I think we will discover that there's nothing particularly indictable and probably nothing that rises to the level of impeachment from that. But then the cover-up, in the old cliche, it's not the crime, but the cover-up, the obstruction of justice and the perjury by members of the transition team and the campaign, I think we'll see if these lead to indictments, but there have already been a couple of them, but this, I think, will be the bigger crisis.
Well, that may be true, but what do you make of the allegation that Jared Kushner tried to set up a direct line between the White House and Russia? I mean, he might not be indicted, but surely we have to consider this a crime, a very high note that we should be aware of.
If true, if proved, that would be a very significant breach of the Logan Act. It would be a significant breach of basic tenets of national security. Time will tell, but I mean, my prediction, David, is that although we picked up this thread in the year 2017, the first year of the Trump administration, I have a feeling that the year 2018 is going to be an extremely momentous year in American constitutional history.
Yes, we all tremble for the fate of our republic.
Hate to see that.
One thing that we did accomplish this year.
What was that?
We finished the Jefferson 101 series.
Catherine, we've
finally.
Been,
yeah,
wow. We've been doing the
our long national nightmare. just kidding.
We've been at it for 2 years.
That, you know, you may have turned me with that, Catherine.
Yeah, so you thought I was the culprit.
Oh, we worked on that over the past year and a half.
We thought there would be maybe 8 or 9 episodes. What did it come to, 20-some?
Yeah, I think so. I haven't, you know.
But we did it. We covered the whole ground.
No, all kidding aside, I think it's a wonderful achievement to have created such a great basis for people who are first coming into the Jefferson Hour to really be able to grasp what the third president stood for.
That's kind of why we started it. I remember talking to Clay and saying, you know, there's a lot of new listeners and there's a lot of basic questions, and maybe we should just do a couple shows on his life.
Two things about that for me. One is that I love doing it because it was out of character, and so
right.
We got to talk about Jefferson, and sometimes there's more insight in that than talking through Thomas Jefferson, and it also was meant to sort of recapitulate years and years of hard reading. Well, you know, what's a new synthesis about Jefferson? I think one is emerging.
And I will say, in defense of the Jefferson 101
yeah.
series,
somebody has to defend it.
No, we got a fair amount of email after the final episode. It was people like, I don't want this book to be done. Can't you continue on? And couldn't you do an episode on what happened to Monticello and everyone who lived there after Jefferson died? And I
keep
thought,
it
yeah,
going,
it was
keep
a
it
good
going.
Idea. Yeah.
No, I appreciate that kind of feedback.
We'll
our
do
listeners.
An aftermath show. How about that?
Jefferson 202.
Yeah, wow. 101A.
Yeah. Now maybe we'll just do an episode, all right?
All right.
As you can hear from the music, it is time for us to take a short break, but we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson. This week, we're speaking with the creator of the Jefferson Hour, Clay Jenkinson. I'm your guest host, Catherine Jenkinson. This week, we're talking about the 2017 in review and special episodes that have occurred throughout the year, including the first episode of 2017, When in Rome.
You did that one, didn't you?
Yes, I was here for that. We spoke about your time in Rome, Dad, and all the experiences you've had to really become an expert on traveling in Italy.
Well, I remember this program because at the end of my last three-week period in Rome, which was a year ago at this time, you came. You were in Scotland, and you were about to go back to the United States, and you came for a week. And among other things, we stayed at this convent, this campus for the University of Mary near the Vatican, and we did a lot of wonderful things in the city. But then we went down to Naples together, and in Naples we actually visited the tomb of the great Latin epic poet Virgil.
And in fact, we were the only people that had been there since Virgil's death some 2,000
well,
years ago.
That's not true.
We had to search high and low in multiple cabs and various subways in Naples, but we eventually found.
The internet took us to the wrong place. We hired a taxi. He took us to the wrong place. It was almost an ordeal, and we were just ready to give up when the last of the taxi drivers took us to the tomb of Virgil. And I have to say, it was extremely moving to me. We took flowers.
Yes,
we knelt, and we all praised to the author of the Aeneid. For those of our listeners who have never read Virgil's Aeneid, at one time it was the most important book in Western civilization, after the Bible. But it ranks with Dante's Inferno, with the Confessions in the City of God of Augustine. It was once a central text for every learned or every educated person in the world. And I've read it in Latin, you've read it in Latin, and to be able to go there with you, after your completion of your time at Columbia University, where you studied the Aeneid, was really a golden opportunity. And one of the things we said on that program was that poor Jefferson didn't get to Rome. He wanted to, but he turned back.
No, we had a wonderful experience, though. And unfortunately, we only had a day. And because it took us 5 or 6 hours to find the tomb
itself. On the Naples thing, yeah.
Yes, then we eventually did not fulfill the second task we had in Naples, which was to have pizza, because
pizza was invented in Naples, and there was this place that you looked up on the internet. It was like, it said, if you only do one thing in Europe, you must go to the, and we went by it,
and
there was a line around the block.
Could we, Dad? And you said, wow. We have to get to the train station. And so we sat at the train station for 2.5 hours before our train came
late. What a terrible, terrible father.
Hungry.
David, pick it up from
there.
Yeah,
I was going to say that's about enough of that. So, but that was a really fun show.
Fun until now.
One of the ones that I really enjoyed selfishly, episode 1226, American Happiness. It gave me a chance to do a bunch of reading, an excuse to do a bunch of reading about the early Philadelphia newspapers. Do you remember that show?
The Aurora and other newspapers.
And also, Monticello was very good to us this year. They shared folks on the air with us. We had a number of different interviews.
But Pat Brodowski, the head gardener there, has been our guest a number of times, and she's outstanding.
But in that show, it was Nia Bates, and she came on and talked about restoration work ongoing at Monticello.
The Sally Hemings quarters.
Uh-huh.
So Monticello is doing all sorts of really interesting things. They've made enslavement, their preferred term, a central issue. They're very proactive about it. There's none of the old defensiveness about slavery or Sally Hemings that existed when I first went to Monticello 30 years ago. It's really an extraordinary thing that's going on there. And she gave a great interview. And then we've been talking off and on with my dear friend, Pat Brodowski. And later, David, and this is one I wish you could have been on, when I did the Shakespeare one-man performance in Norfolk, Virginia, I took some fans, some 1776 Club members, up to the gardens at Monticello, and Pat had a garden festival for us.
Oh, I wish I could have been there.
And believe me, she would pull stuff off the vines, and then we took it to a picnic table. And then she made this salad on the spot, every bit of it. She had made the dressing. She had harvested the mustard, all of the leaf and other materials that went into the salad were plucked at that minute. And she had made some cider that we drank. It was a purely agrarian, Jeffersonian, moment, and it was absolutely thrilling. And so we reach out to the people at Monticello, and particularly our dear friend Pat.
We need to talk to her again soon. And actually, show 1231, which was in April, beginning of May, we spent a bunch of time talking to Pat. Do you remember that show?
That huge garden, you know, it was really the work of Peter Hatch. And he has that splendid book about Jefferson's gardens. And he really restored the gardens. When I first went to Monticello, they weren't much of anything. And now they're one of the central attractions of the foundation.
What I learned from Pat in that episode was, if I recall correctly, I always thought of his gardens as being kind of a way to supply the house with different vegetables. And in fact, when you read into it, they were experimental plots.
Yeah, mostly it was a
laboratory. That's not to say they didn't eat the produce, but it was his way of experimenting.
Yes, David, this was before the Morrill Act. You know, the Morrill Act gave us our land-grant colleges, Kansas State University, North Dakota State University, Iowa State, et cetera. And they are especially endowed to be laboratories of agricultural science and to disseminate the best thinking about agriculture to the citizens of that state and the citizens of the world. That didn't exist yet. That didn't come until well after the Civil War. So in Jefferson's time, he took it upon himself to be a sort of one-man land-grant experimental farm. And he had seeds from the Lewis and Clark expedition and seeds from Italy and France and seeds from all over. And then he would grow them and disseminate them and keep extremely good and accurate records about them. And so that giant garden, the length of 3 football fields, I think, at Monticello is not the garden from which they ate, although, as you say, they did eat what was produced, but it's the garden where he experimented in horticulture.
Yes, and of course, your gardening episodes are all very wonderful, but I also really enjoyed show 1233, Neither Wolf Nor Dog, about author Kent Nerburn's book, Neither Wolf Nor Dog, which has now been made into a movie, and discusses...
We saw the film.
Okay.
We saw the film separately, and I'm a big fan of Neither Wolf Nor Dog. I think it, and I agree with you, David, that it's the best primer, the best sort of introduction to...
The book, yeah.
What it's like to be a Native American in the 21st century, caught between cultures, on the res, off the res, having to live in two worlds, learning how to negotiate those two worlds and how the two worlds really don't understand each other and really don't always speak the same vocabulary.
And Kent is such a gracious man.
And
such a great guy. Always fun to talk
that's,
to.
That's
good
of,
insight.
That's part of a trilogy of books. Plus he has a biographical study of Chief Joseph and the last tragic journey of the Nez Perce. But Catherine, this program was sort of about that. It was mostly about the film that was made. And the film was a low-budget film, and the maker, Stephen Lewis Simpson, was on to talk about the process, David. And I think you were fascinated by this, but ultimately you prefer the book.
Well, isn't that almost always the case?
It is. But Catherine, you and I and my mother, your grandmother, had the experience of seeing another important Native American film this year.
Yes, well, it's not a Native American film, but it is a film that discusses some issues that affect many Native American women. The movie Wind River, starring Jeremy Renner and Elizabeth Olsen, is an excellent study of a fictional rape and murder case on Wind River in Wyoming.
A crime occurs on the Wind River Reservation. The FBI comes in. Turns into a nightmare.
Yes, it's very similar to, in some ways, very similar to Louise Erdrich's book, The Roundhouse, which won the National Book Award several years ago.
And you had a chance to meet her.
And I met Louise Erdrich in New
York. She's a North Dakotan.
A North Dakotan from Wahpeton. And, of course, she owns her incredible bookstore, Birchbark Books in Minneapolis.
That's a great place, isn't it?
Oh, it's fantastic.
Catherine,
she's wonderful.
I always spend too much money when I go.
She had a reading. It was at Barnes & Noble, wasn't it?
Yes, it was a Barnes & Noble on the Upper West Side of New York, and I walked in about 5 minutes late because I was coming directly from a class, and I was wearing a Birchbark Books t-shirt, and she stopped what she was doing and reading, and she said, "Someone just walked in here with a Birchbark Books t-shirt," and I couldn't have been more thrilled. But anyway, just to return to this question, Wind River is really an incredible movie that anyone with an interest in this, anyone who doesn't have an interest in this, should see. And I would also recommend reading the books of Louise Erdrich. And of course, the wonderful and hilarious and moving books of Sherman Alexie. This fall, I just reread The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian,
with children's your younger
book,
sister.
With my younger sister, who's 12, and it could not be more incredible in any way. It's a truly great book for the young and old alike.
This is a subject of great interest to David and great interest to you, Catherine. And as long as we're on the subject, David, I mean, people who listen to this program will remember the DAPL pipeline controversy that rocked North Dakota in the year 2016 and part of 17.
North Dakota and the rest of the country.
Catherine, tell the story of taking my mother to the reservation.
Well, as you've mentioned earlier in this program, I have been away from North Dakota for some time. And so when I came home for Christmas in January, I really wanted to go to the campsite. I had heard about it, read about it, seen pictures of it, watched Neil Young's video there, and really was so upset by the response of many North Dakotans toward this very important movement. And so I asked you if we could go. We decided to go. The weather was bad, and we were just observers, and we were there for far too short a time.
But I'll say this about my mother. My mother's 86. She was very skeptical of the protests. She thought it had been taken over by outside forces, by celebrities, that professional protesters were there, etc. And she did not want to go, but you insisted.
Well, I thought it was something to see, and I'm so glad that we went. And I wish that we had been involved in the way that so many people have been. We weren't, but we were so happy to see a very peaceful and clean camp, and to hear about this extremely important issue.
When my mother went, she went reluctantly. But when we drove back up North Dakota 6 to Mandan, my mother said to Catherine, "Thank you. I'm so glad I saw this. I've changed my view of this because I went there." Isn't that something?
That's great.
Getting back to Jefferson, I think Jefferson would have said that by the 21st century, if he could have looked that far ahead, there would not be Native Americans, that Native Americans would have been totally absorbed in if they took 23andMe tests or if they took Ancestry.com tests, they would discover they were partly Cherokee or partly Mandan or partly Crow. I think he thought that there would be a total amalgamation of the cultures. And I think he would be thrilled and delighted to think that in the 21st century, Native Americans are still Native Americans, that they have clung to their cultures.
Clay, you must have had some favorite shows from 2017. Do you recall anything you really enjoyed?
Oh, you know, I think the one on what would we take Jefferson to see?
Oh, right.
Remember that one?
Yeah, I do.
And I love those programs.
A listener asked us to do that one.
So that was sort of saying, well, what would Jefferson want to see? Would he want to see a heart transplant? Would he want to see the DNA code?
I think you had him driving through Montana in RVs, didn't you?
I might have put him in an RV.
Yeah.
But those programs always are delightful to me. And I love it when our listeners pose this sort of question. And it goes from this, I think you remember this question I got from a fifth grader long, long, long ago, 30 years ago. And she said, "Now that you've spent some time with us, Mr. Jefferson, what would you like to take back with you?" And what a great question. You know, what a great question. I finally wound up saying penicillin, but I wanted to say Ronco splatter screen or pocket fisherman or maybe Ginzu knives, but I didn't. I played it straight and said penicillin.
Then there was show 1239, original argument about Jefferson and Hamilton presenting their arguments to Mr. Washington.
And Hamilton won the debate for broad construction, flexible construction of the Constitution, and he was almost certainly right. You know, the Tea Party and the diehards and I, in some moods, wish that we had had a strictly construed Constitution. But Hamilton said, look, do you want to be a great nation or don't you? And if you want to be a great nation, you have to have flexibility in what you do. Don't bind yourself in a straitjacket here about what government can take on as technologies change and demographics change in the world, geopolitical situation changes. So that was an interesting program. You know, Hamilton was a policy wonk, indefatigable. He could produce reams of argumentation, and he was a brilliant arguer. A great rhetorician and a tremendous command of facts and a brilliant prose stylist in his own more incisive way from Jefferson. And Jefferson was a gentleman who always wanted to be above it and didn't want to get his fingers dirty in the process. And so Hamilton could essentially run circles around Jefferson when he wanted to.
We did a number of programs about some of the dark periods, the election of 1800, the Alien and Sedition Act. I enjoyed those shows very much.
Me too. And remember, we did one on presidential deportment because we were asked by listeners to try to make sense of the deportment of the current occupant of the presidency and to contrast it. We talked about Jefferson's ideas of presidential comportment, and it was a pretty interesting contrast.
Yeah, that was show 1239, Presidential Decorum.
Right. Jefferson had exquisite manners, and you know, he believed that you must behave as a gentleman at all times.
But he was kind of frumpy in the White House. He dressed like the average Joe and all that.
Well, he wanted people to realize that he was not King George III or the Pope. You know, he wanted people to see him as a kind of scholar, farmer, citizen. He wasn't that. He was an aristocrat, but he kind of dressed down to make a point.
And then there was the show Presidential Talents, highlighting all of the things that Jefferson could do, and we wondered whether you could do them. Is that right?
Yes, it's a then-now program. I love those programs. And when I'm introduced around the country, a version of that, of Parton's sentence, is always used. Jefferson could tie an artery, calculate an eclipse, read Homer and Plutarch in the original Greek, speak respectfully to farmers and clergymen and so on. And so I saw that sentence in my reading, and I thought, let's do a program on each of those things that he is said to have been able to do, and we did. And then I thought, what can I do? Could I tie an artery? And we decided, no, I probably couldn't tie an artery. Could I calculate an eclipse?
Probably not. Yeah, under duress, you probably could.
I think maybe.
Yeah.
We'd have to, but what it tells you is what a Renaissance man he was. And, you know, just think of calculating eclipse. If you said to me, without consulting almanacs or the internet, tell me when the next eclipse of the sun will occur in North America, I'd be a very long time in graduate school before I could give you that information. So, you know, he was an extraordinarily well-educated man.
You bring up the eclipse. We actually did. Well, you did.
And you did.
No, you did. You did a location recording of your voyage to witness the eclipse.
I had been extremely busy. I got home and I thought, you know what? I'm not going to watch an 80% eclipse. If I'm going to do the eclipse, I'm going to go do it. So I had a couple of days and I drove down into the heart of Wyoming, right in the eclipse corridor.
And it turned out after the fact that we were not that far apart.
You know, about 20 miles apart. And I took a recorder and I recorded my impressions. And you can hear it. You can hear the almost boyish, childlike sense of wonder. Catherine, it was you were in Scotland. You didn't see it, I'm sure.
No eclipse.
When the next one happens, I can't remember the year.
2026, I think.
Go there. Don't say, oh, 95% is good enough. It's not. You have to see it in totality.
I mean, you were there with Jan and your son. What was your experience?
It's like one of those things that happens in your life and changes your perspective on everything forever. And
wow.
I don't think that's overstating it. I really don't.
You feel that you live in a solar system.
It's really difficult to describe just how impressive it is to witness a total eclipse. And I would encourage anybody that has the chance to witness one not to miss it. Agree?
No, I felt, Jefferson's concept of the sublime, something beyond your capacity to articulate how wonderful and soulful experience it is.
Well stated, sir. We have a bunch more shows to reflect on from 2017, How Time Flies. We need to take a short break.
Well, we have the third segment and an essay.
You're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. This week, we're taking a look back at all the shows on the Jefferson Hour from 2017. We're going to take a short break, but we'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with or about President Thomas Jefferson. Actually, this week, we're talking about the Thomas Jefferson Hour, looking back at the many episodes, 52 of them, from 2017. And before we forget, we need to thank some of the folks who have been guests, not just guest hosts, but guests on the Thomas Jefferson Hour. And one gentleman that we haven't talked to him for a while. I need to get reach out to him, Bo Wright.
Right.
Yes.
The former Obama aide.
Yeah, he was just brilliant and great fun to talk to. He spent 5 years serving in the White House, nearly 2 years of that time as senior deputy director of White House operations and director for finance.
Now he's down near Lynchburg.
And it was just really fun to talk to. We thought it would be interesting to get a perspective from somebody who had spent time inside the White House.
And I think he talked about decorum and the crises that roll through any administration and the infighting and the personnel issues and how you maintain control of something as high profile and chaotic as a presidential administration in the 21st century, with, of course, some reflection on the currently troubled one.
We did a show 1238 on presidential decorum where we spoke to Mr. Jefferson about that and followed that up the next week, episode 1239, with one called Original Argument. And that was really a fun one for me. We talked with Jefferson about the decision by President Washington to support Alexander Hamilton's plan over Jefferson's plan.
And Hamilton basically won the debate for the soul of the U.S. Constitution. He believed that the Constitution should be an enabling document that allowed maximum flexibility for a great nation to chart its course through a series of social, political, and geopolitical arenas, and that to have a strictly construed Constitution of the sort that Jefferson had in mind would be a form of national suicide.
We did a couple of programs in August that I think were perhaps two of the more important Jefferson Hour shows we did in 2017. It started at the beginning of the month, a show called This Thing of Darkness, number 1245.
Oh my, yes. Let me tell Catherine what happened. So we got a letter from someone who, remind me if I'm wrong, David, but who found it almost impossible to have any respect for Jefferson because of slavery.
Or the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Or what we were doing. And so we thought, instead of, we always talk about slavery 6-10 times a year in one form or another, and we thought, instead of just doing another program, let's do it out of character and let's really wrestle with this. Let's not in any way try to hide behind the historical moment or anything else. Let's really just...
So I reached out to this listener and said, okay, you have our attention. Tell us what it is and how you feel and, you know, don't hold anything back. And she did. And it turned out to be a wonderful dialogue. To me, it was reaffirming. You know, we look at the times we live in now and we think we're just, there's no hope. But if you're a Jeffersonian, you know there is. You know, what we're living in now is just a small slice of time.
Sure.
I mean, it's just a small slice of time. And we get so discouraged about what's going on in government currently, but the pendulum swings from one side to the other. And sometimes it needs to go very far down in order for us to recognize that there is an up. And for me, that's what that show did is, you know, this person was so upset with Jefferson, so upset with us. And yet, when I wrote to her in a Jeffersonian fashion and said, we really want to hear your point of view, we started a dialogue and it was great. And I think both of us learned something. So I think that was one of the better shows we did in spite of how difficult it was.
But Catherine, let me ask you a question. You've been out of the country. You know, you've been around the world of Thomas Jefferson all your life, really. At this point, given what we know about slavery, Sally Hemings, race, how much weight does that problem, that incredibly serious problem in Jefferson's life, how much weight should that have? Because there are people, as you know, that would knock him off the pedestal altogether and just say he has to go with Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson and so on. And there are other people who say, well, wait a minute now. We have to give it weight, but we have to know where that weight really should be calibrated. How do you see it?
Well, I think it's an impossible question, but I think that these are important issues that are worth noting and need to always be attached to Jefferson's name with an asterisk. However, I subscribe to the whole man theory, and I think it's much easier to find positive and wonderful traits in Jefferson than it would be in someone like Stonewall Jackson or other Confederates, powerful Confederate generals from the Civil War. However, we can never think of Jefferson or Washington or any number of other of our founding fathers as purely positive figures because, though of course we have to acknowledge that they were men of their own time, these are traits in them that we cannot stand for.
So you went to Columbia University. If you had just said what you said now on a stage at Columbia, you might have gotten booed off the stage.
Yes, absolutely. And just because we disagree, or maybe not disagree, but we have sort of different understandings of these issues, does not mean that we should discredit those who don't wholly agree with us. And I think that a dialogue, at the very least, is always worth having on issues such as these. And I find my own hypocrisy in agreeing that Confederate statues should be taken out of city centers, especially those that were built in the 20th century, but disagreeing with the removal of statues of people like Cecil Rhodes or Thomas Jefferson. So,
but you know, I mean, the title of that program came from The Tempest.
Sure.
This Thing of Darkness I Acknowledge Mine. And my point was, all of us have much to answer for.
Oh, of course, of course. And we all have, or many of us, I should say, have mixed feelings about this. And we can appreciate so many things about the man and hate much of his behavior or hate many of the things that he did in his life. And so I think that this conversation isn't over. It shouldn't be over. And we should continue to think about this. But we shouldn't make any final decisions now.
But remember, David, I said, I think in that program, that it has actually led me to wonder whether we should continue doing this program, that I actually have moments, there are still a minority, but there are moments every year when I think maybe it's irresponsible not to talk about Jefferson, because of course he's essential to.
Yeah, I don't think I properly responded to that.
Yeah, what's your view?
You might think that, but I
do have those moments.
I certainly do not. And I'll give you another show as evidence of that. Jefferson's a way to work through things. Jefferson's a way to get perspective on things. And at the end of August, you called me and said, you know, I know we don't have anything scheduled. We got to do a show now.
Oh, the Charlottesville white supremacist riot. I called you. I don't normally do that, as you know. And I said, you know, we have to get into the barn right now. We can't let this pass. This happened in Jefferson's community at his university. This is something that we can hardly call yourselves serious Jeffersonians if you don't want to come in and face that issue. It was hard. And I'm still shocked by this, that in the 21st century, there could be Americans marching in a university town saying, no Jews, or put the Jews in their place, or blacks belong back on the plantation, or, you know, all the things that were said.
I really think all of that is fueled by fear.
I do too.
It's the same, you know, it's interesting now, if you watch the news, the word tribalism or tribal behavior has come up again. And I think that sort of fear fuels the political discourse. And until we have a national figure, a leader that can gain all of our attention at the same time, we're going to suffer that.
Then who will it take? I mean, what sort of leader could possibly have that sort of effect? I think of many of our previous presidents who have shown great elegance and sophistication and positivity and erudition.
Including Barack Obama.
Including, of course, Barack Obama and George H.W. Bush. And to certain extents, even George W. Bush and Bill Clinton. So who will it be, and who could possibly have that sort of power to encourage?
Let me ask each one of you a very quick question. First, you, David. Did you believe before Charlottesville that in the second decade of the 21st century you would hear open anti-Semitic shouts in the street?
Oh, absolutely.
You did, Catherine?
No, I actually was really surprised. But I also, of course, have to acknowledge that I have placed myself in what some might call liberal
privileged bubbles, yes,
where that kind of behavior is absolutely unacceptable. I would have thought that Charlottesville would have been one
immune
of those places, maybe not a leftist community, but
No. This is the age we live in where passions are encouraged without forethought. It's just, it's spew your opinion, and I really think that's true.
I actually thought that the world was beyond outspoken anti-Semitism, and I was simply wrong.
There is no gain or purpose in separating those. It's all the same to me. But I hate to do this because the conversation is good.
We have to move on.
I need to thank Catherine for being here. There's so much more we could be discussing.
Catherine, you'll come back to do more shows, I hope.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
But now it is time for this week's Jefferson Watch.
As the year 2017 stumbles to its close, I'm reminded of one of the finest things that Jefferson ever wrote. In the face of a distant family scandal, Jefferson urged his daughter Martha to remember that every human being must be viewed according to what it is good for. For not one of us, no, not one, is perfect, and were we to love none who had imperfections, this world would be a desert for our love. As I look around me at the end of this tumultuous year, I can only wonder how we fell into this morass of distrust, righteousness, recrimination, and rancor. It has been an icky year, if I may use a technical term. The Charlottesville March of White Supremacists, the crisis and possible collapse of the NFL, not just over the silent protests begun by Colin Kaepernick, but the engulfing brain injury pandemic that has taken much of the joy out of the game. The fall, usually deserved, of such national icons as Matt Lauer, Harvey Weinstein, Al Franken, Charlie Rose, and hundreds of less prominent individuals. We have lurched toward the brink of an international crisis in North Korea. We all sense that it will not end in horrific conflagration, but that is precisely what people thought after the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand in Sarajevo on June 28, 1914. Can anyone really think the president's response to North Korea and its leader, the threats, the name-calling, the bluster, has made this conflict less likely? Did the Trump campaign collude with the Russians? Of course, we know they did, though possibly not Donald Trump himself. We know there was obstruction of justice. We have witnessed it on national television. But about a quarter of the electorate is so besotted with anger and resentment that they actually argued that the Trump team's violations of federal law and willingness to commit treason against the sovereignty of the United States is okay because it sure beats having Hillary Clinton as president. Think of that. We are stumbling towards a constitutional crisis, possibly an impeachment crisis, and we cannot even reach a consensus on what minimal standards we demand from our chief executive and his cohorts. So far from being back and great again, America has lost some of its standing in the world this year. Our closest friends doubt our capacity to lead the world now. Such leadership as now exists is more likely to come out of Berlin than Washington. Think of that sentence. And America's decline is being counterbalanced by the rising power of China in the Pacific, because it really is true that nature abhors a vacuum. Everyone I know is anxious about health care, because health care is not merely politics like taxes or interest rates, but the central issue of life and death. It does no good for us to have, as the cliche has it, the finest health care system in the world, if millions of good Americans do not have access to it at all, and tens of millions more have no assurance that the system will continue to deliver something even the middle class can afford in the decades ahead. At year's end, Obamacare hangs on by a thread, and though the rhetoric has been passionate and often violent, very little actual effort has been made to give the American people the assurance that they will get the care they need when they need it. Every day now, there is a hot debate in the national media about the president's latest outrage to decorum, honesty, decency, professional deportment, and America's reputation at home and abroad. You can take 2 weeks off and pick up the argument just where you left it off. It's so dreary, so wearying, so predictable, so unhelpful to anything the United States needs to be attending to in this time of domestic and international uncertainty. Stop the world. I want to get off. For the first time in my life, I have actually been fantasizing about moving to Europe or to Great Britain. I wonder how many of you have seriously contemplated just packing up and leaving. When I was in Britain last week, I had long conversations with friends who said, among other things, that they never have to worry about health care, student debt, access to education, or a safety net that ensures a decent subsistence to everyone. Call it socialism if you want, but Northern Europeans get a great deal from their slightly higher tax bill, most significantly a sense of security and social stability. I won't move, probably, because I love the American West, the Buttes, the Badlands, the Little Missouri River, Yellowstone National Park, and besides, what European country wants me? We need to lower the national temperature. We need to ratchet the fierce debates down, not up. We need to check righteousness at the door and try to explain ourselves and our principles, rather than browbeat, denounce, dismiss, condemn, and deride. We need to forbear, forgive, forswear, and forget. We need to turn back towards harmony. In his first inaugural address, Jefferson said, "Let us restore to social intercourse that harmony and affection without which liberty and even life itself are but dreary things." Amen. We need to turn a corner from this age of madness into a new era of good feeling. You and I cannot make that happen as a national resurrection, but we can do what little we can in the smaller arenas of our individual lives and communities. As you look forward to the new year, I have the following advice, which comes from a lifetime of studying the life and achievement of Thomas Jefferson. Ratchet things down in 2018, not up. Practice deliberate moderation, civility, and generosity of spirit. Don't take the bait. Reach out to those with whom you are at odds. Renew old friendships. Facebook has made it possible to find people at the far margins of our lives. Turn off your television and radio, particularly Fox and MSNBC, Rush and Sean, and Glenn and Michael Savage. Take long walks. Plan your garden and tend it with simple, loving care. Read more, much more, some of it out of your own favorite genres. Clean up your vocabulary and your grammar. Avoid talking points. Try to imagine the point of view of those you most disagree with. Practice the art of true conversation. Eat less and better. Write letters, possibly even some physical ones. Believe to the extent that it is possible in the goodness of humanity. Try to remember that the other, Muslims, Mexicans, American Indians, the transgendered, Iranians, North Koreans, are people not very different from you, though they may run a different Surface software. As President John F. Kennedy said at American University on June 10, 1963, "For in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet, we all breathe the same air, we all cherish our children's future, and we are all mortal." That simple sentence of the basic brotherhood of man probably cost John F. Kennedy his life. Here's to a better 2018. Keep listening, please, and reach out today to someone with joy, respect, and harmony. I'm Clay Jenkinson. We'll see you next year for another exciting year of the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
The Thomas Jefferson Hour is brought to you each week by Dakota Sky Education. The program is distributed nationally by Prairie Public Radio. President Thomas Jefferson lived from 1743 to 1826, and this program presents his views. President Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay S. Jenkinson. To obtain a copy of this or any past show for a $12 donation, please call 888-828-2853. Again, that number is 888-828-2853. This program is also available online at jeffersonhour.org and on iTunes. If you'd like to correspond with President Jefferson or submit a question for him to answer on the program, please visit the website at jeffersonhour.org. The Thomas Jefferson Hour is produced at Mokoche Recording Studios in Bismarck, North Dakota. Music by Stephen Swinford. Thank you for listening. Please tune in again next week for another thought-provoking, historically accurate program through the eyes of Thomas Jefferson.